Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Butler Financial Podcast. This is Mikio Butler speaking to you from Denver, Colorado on July 2nd, 2020. Mark and I recorded the following conversation a few days ago on Monday, June 29th, in response to this quite unusual and surprisingly difficult moment for all of us as investors. What makes this moment difficult? Ironically, the degree of certainty that seems to be available about two basic facts. The first is that we can expect poor economic fundamentals, at least in the short term, and the second is that stock market valuations are quite high by historical standards. It sure seems like better clarity about two major contributors to any macroeconomic outlook should significantly improve the quality of that outlook and our ability to build a successful investment strategy around it. But behavioral finance warns us that substitution bias will likely cause this sense of certainty to, in aggregate, work against us. Here, we must credit foremost the work of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, and we wholeheartedly recommend that any interested listener read Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, in which he lays out in plain English the heuristics and cognitive biases that any serious investor, Mark and myself very much included, must spend a great deal of time and energy revealing and observing in his or her own cognitive and analytical processes. Think of this as the study of the mechanics of cognition. These are the shortcuts our mind relies on to efficiently reach conclusions, and thus we will notice that it systematically errs in certain situations. Substitution bias crops up when we're faced with a hard question that we're unable to answer, either because we don't have the time or the expertise. So what frequently happens then is we substitute a related question for which an answer is readily available. But the real trick here is that we're not conscious of the substitution, and thus we think we've answered the original complex question, which of course is the correct question, and we proceed accordingly, unfortunately sometimes with disastrous consequences. In this case, the correct but more complex question is, how should we allocate our capital in a way that accomplishes our goals while addressing short, medium, and longer term risks? Whereas the simpler question that we're tempted to substitute because we feel it's easy to answer is, are stocks likely to go up or down over the next year or two? So I hope this conversation adequately challenges our feelings of certainty about the answer to this substitute question, and then helps us refocus on the right question and how we might go about answering it. Okay, please stay healthy, please stay safe, enjoy.
Good morning, everyone. Mark Butler here with Mikio Butler. Good morning, Mikio.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, everyone.
It's Monday, June 29th. Quite the year it's been so far. Hope this finds everyone well. We thought it was a good moment now to share with you what's our mind in terms of markets and economy, earnings, risk, growth, not growth, more thoughts on risk. So it's a little bit of where to and a little bit of how to be as an investor at this particular moment in time. As most of you know, Mikio is a charter holder, a CFA charter holder, and brings a kind of depth of expertise and understanding around some of the portfolio management. And so I guess the only other comments I'd make is this morning or coming into today, the S&P 500 is around 3,000 down. The U.S. markets or stocks are down about 6.5%, and the international stocks are down about 11% year to date. That being said, we know that there's a cluster, which most of you all own, of NASDAQ-type stocks, the Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Adobe, that's done very well. And with that as a kind of lead-off, Mikio, would you share a few words where you want to take this conversation?
Yes, absolutely. One of the key themes here for us is to really try to frame the present situation for, an intelligent, steady, long-term investor
nevertheless, one who's dealing with the cognitive challenge of apparent certainty around difficult economic fundamentals, let's say, for a significant period of time. Even in a better case scenario, let's just say, we absolutely agree with anyone who thinks that, you know, there will be some knock-on effects and some need to deleverage in parts of the economy as we work our way through this pandemic, this COVID-19 pandemic. And so in the face of that, you know, why would anyone own stocks if not at a terrific valuation? And, you know, stocks have come all the way back to, Mark, as you said, S&P 3000, not substantially down on the year. Surely these can't be the right valuations. Valuations were perhaps modestly stretched before this pandemic, and in the face of a pandemic, right, relative to that fact, they must be even more stretched.
If I may, yeah, just to underline that before, yeah, you really get galloping here, is that we agree with some of the hypothesis out there that there are going to be headwinds. There will be winners and there will be some very painful losers in this thing that's in front of us. We could call it a recession. Certainly earnings will be impacted. As you'll also touch on, there are other risks afoot: inflation, the governments printing money. Someone has to pay that bill at some point in time. We won't even touch on the political risks that loom. Everyone is thinking about them as well and perhaps getting ahead of themselves. But anyway, I just wanted to kind of note, we certainly are thinking about what it means to be an investor with the possibility of a 2-3, maybe even a 4-year lackluster economy in general terms. Again, I think there will be some winners and some losers. But anyway, I just wanted for us to dwell in the what we perceive as the likely truth of this moment.
Yes, absolutely. And so in light of that truth, I think the our hope today is to really illuminate and explore the important gap between that reality and then the really understandable instinct that perhaps we should go risk off, right? That in light of the fact that there will be economic challenges and there will be serious challenges for earnings for at least some sectors of the stock market, and in light of the fact that we're starting from a relatively elevated valuation broadly, that we might want to go risk off, right? We might want to sell stocks. We might want to quote unquote go to cash, and this is
which is the most extreme.
That's the most extreme, correct?
But, and it's market time.
But even correct. But even let's just say you said I'm at 60% equities. Why not go to 40% equities?
Fair,
right?
Fair question.
And so the point here is not so much to, you know, have qualms with the level of extremeness. I think the first issue conceptually to take on is, are we even thinking the right way about what to do with high valuations and economic challenges? Because that's actually not even the right frame. It's not a question of how much risk assets should we own in response to this present moment. How much risk assets should we own is a question for the investment policy, right? Is a question for the long-term plan, is a question for long-term, you know, risk tolerance, willingness, and ability to take risk. That's a highly relevant question. It's not any more relevant because we're in a particular macroeconomic moment. And so what do I mean by that? It would only make sense if all risk assets were radically overpriced, right? Just across the board, every sector relative to its, you know, plausible growth rate were equally overpriced, as was risky debt, distressed debt, distressed real estate, all kinds of alternative strategies. Every single sub-asset class under the risk asset bucket, if they were all precisely equally overpriced, and you had good safe bonds, you know, to pay you a reasonable return, you might define that as 3% or 5% or 7%, but something, then maybe that's a reasonable way to think about the world. We're not remotely in that situation. So as a result, the real question is how to reposition within risk assets in an intelligent way in response to this environment. And we are not opposed to tactical tilts. We're not opposed to, you know, taking risk from 60% to 55%. But even then, the point in that kind of tactical tilt is where that capital is going, right? We're not sitting here betting on cash, right? So it may go to cash in the short term. But if cash is our best idea, frankly, don't even do that. You know, don't even go from 60 to 55. So let's, I just to put some numbers to this, I'd like to just get not too far in the weeds, but just really talk about what we mean when we say high valuations, because I think that that's maybe, you know, the nebulous part of the statement for most folks, right? I think most intelligent people have, you know, some tangible sense of why and how, you know, economic challenges might unfold. Not precisely how, but that they will. And again, we're not here to argue with that. But basically, we read stuff, we hear stuff. Valuations are high, stocks are high. So I'd like to challenge that. I think most people, when they say that and when they start with that point of view, they're not wrong, but they don't totally know what that really means. And so what does that mean? Valuations, right? We talk about multiples. We talk about, you know, an earnings multiple, 20 times earnings. If a share of a stock is going to generate a dollar of earnings from the underlying company, we're paying $20 for it. Therefore, a 20 times multiple. But that, you know, feels really arbitrary. And just heady conceptual until we get to really the more basic question when we're talking about risk assets, which is what's the risk and what am I getting for taking that risk. So there, I would say we're flipping it around. It's what's called the earnings yield, which is instead of thinking about it as 20 times earnings, it's saying I'm going to put $20 of my capital into this stock, or I have the option to do so. What am I getting for it? Well, I'm getting a dollar of earnings, right? With a certain risk that dollar falls to 50 cents of earnings, with a certain possibility that dollar doubles to $2 of earnings, right? And so that's really the key way to think about that. When we think about it that way, we actually have a very different conversation about stocks versus cash versus bonds, right? So everybody wants to say stocks are overvalued, and they are well above their long-term average in terms of valuation, right? So for instance, the valuation metric, not perfect, no valuation metric is, but Shiller's CAPE ratio, cyclically adjusted price earnings, it basically accounts for, you know, the cyclicality of the business cycle, ups and downs in earnings and inflation. And so by that measure, today, the cyclically adjusted price earnings on the S&P is 28.5 times versus kind of, you know, long-term average somewhere in the teens. Depends on what period of time you're looking at, but let's just say high teens. I think most people would say, you know, reasonable multiple if you can get broad-based, you know, U.S. stocks in the high teens, you have a really high probability of doing well over time. So right now we're at 28.5 times. Seems kind of overpriced. Wouldn't argue it kind of is. However, I think if we pan back, right, we can and should do the same thing to your safe haven assets, to U.S. Treasuries, right? And then we need to make adjustments because they're not the same asset at all. They don't have the same risk profile. But If you've got just under 0.7% of yield on the 10-year treasury, right, what multiple is that, right? It's a lot higher than 28. It's 140 something times, right? So you'd have to own 10-year treasuries at this yield for 147 years, right, to fully get your capital out, to double your capital once, right? I can tell you there are very few people who think that you're not going to lose to inflation substantially in that time. With inflation, you're going to tend to get, you know, a doubling in consumer prices every 30 to 40 years.
So you're pointing right now to what you and I and other investment professionals will call the structural impact of the markets, that there are relative dynamics that investors, intermediate to long term, and traders are both thinking about how, because capital always has to find a home.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly right. And so we're starting at this very high level and then kind of digging down from there into you know, the conversations that I think people should be focused on, right? About those kind of sub asset classes within the risk asset bucket. So basically, right, like if it's quite interesting to look at what's happened in the last 40 years, right? Stock market has produced extraordinary returns in the last 40 years. Surely stocks have gone from a reasonable valuation to a totally unreasonable valuation. There again, I'd frame it differently and I'd say partially true, right? It's the valuation has increased dramatically. But stocks have gone from, again, using the that Shiller valuation multiple, they've gone from about 9 times earnings, the Shiller adjusted earnings in 1981. God, wish we could buy it there, right? But they've gone from 9 to 28.5, right? So seems troubling until you remember that treasury bonds have done something dramatically more extreme, right? At that time, the 10-year yield jacked up to about 15%. Your multiple was 7 times, right? Roughly, a little under 7 times, right? And so treasury bonds have gone from 7 times to 147 times, right? So that's the by far, you know, more dramatic, you know, arguably more troubling.
And this is something we've talked about internally. We've tended to not put it in our client message because the obvious and overt risk profile or risk asset is equities,
yes,
stocks, real estate,
yes,
as the two yes, conspicuous major asset classes. Would you say a little something here about the multiple to earnings in a low interest rate environment?
Yes, absolutely. So there are two ways to think about this. One is the structural way, which is kind of what we're thinking about right now, which is essentially saying relative to the fact that, you know, you can earn more or less nothing if you're not willing to take risk based on the prevailing interest rate environment, right? 0.67%, you know, on a 10-year treasury. Suddenly lower yields look more attractive, right? And that's when we're talking about the earnings yield, right? That's what is meant, right? So you buy a $20 stock and you get $1 of earnings. There's an environment in which that feels like not enough earnings, you know, that you're not getting enough for the risk that you're taking. But again, if your alternative is to invest that $20 in a money market fund and get a few cents, suddenly that dollar looks really nice, right? And so that's the comparative structural factor.
So that's what zero interest rates is doing, is making the CFAs around the globe,
yep,
sharpen the pencil and say, what is the multiple on that dollar of earnings now?
Correct.
And then if there are companies where there's even more growth.
Yep, exactly.
Right. So, but if you go to the S&P 500, last year it was $170 a share, $170 of earnings, right, for the whole, right, index. This year is a wash.
Who knows? Yeah.
Everyone's looking at next year.
Yep.
Let's just say it comes in at $130,
yes,
right?
Yep.
So that's 22% or something below, it's
yes,
substantially,
yes,
below,
yes,
25% below the 170.
Yep.
And, but maybe that 130 gets a 25 times.
Correct. Correct. Entirely plausible, right?
And if that's the case, then our current 3,000 on the S&P is just about right.
Is just about right. And not only is it just about right, perhaps it's too low, right, with a short to intermediate term view. Now, I want to be careful about what I'm saying there, because I am not saying, you know, go lever up on stocks here. What I'm saying is, you know, when you get into, right, we've seen something in the Treasury market that 20 years ago we would have said is implausible, if not impossible, right? And so the point is, it has we've never seen this before, right? It has that, you know, kind of characteristic of a bubble, in the sense that it's something that no one's ever seen in this precise way, and so no one's ever seen exactly how it unravels. Which doesn't mean it's the most catastrophic thing in history, but it will be incredibly painful, you know, to some, you know, sovereign wealth funds, portions of the economy, who knows exactly what. We don't know exactly how that will ripple outward. And so the point is, you know, that's why you get such an extreme run between, you know, basically getting your capital out on a treasury investment in 7 years, about 40 years ago, versus getting it out in 147 years, right? And so that's the point, which is that if something like the treasury market can run to such an extreme that, you know, that would have seemed, you know, totally implausible, unimaginable, you know, 20 years ago, then really it is that thing of, like, if that extreme persists, then, you know, frankly, stocks will still be undervalued relative to treasuries at 35 or 40 times earnings. Again, not saying go out and buy stocks speculating that,
that one, there is a modicum of risk that stocks could go higher.
Yeah,
even
absolutely.
If you and I
absolutely
don't totally, you know, want to believe that or espouse
right.
it.
Right.
We acknowledge there is a probability,
yes,
that you can't deny. The other thing I want to say before we kind of turn and head for home here is back to the tactical comment, whether it's 60% stock portfolio to 55 or 48 mm-hmm. or 45,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
That's probably about more or less as low as we will generally
go
in a heavy defense. I'd like you to just speak to the David Swensen comment about how, particularly as one of my hypotheses is that inflation really does loom here, and it does come, you know, home to roost sooner. If that's true, as Swensen noted, short term stocks may or may not be the well synchronized hedge mm-hmm. against inflation, but intermediate to long term, they've been very powerful hedges. Obviously, you've got to select parts of the economy that have the giddy up to keep pace. Would you just say a little bit, and then we'll bring this this podcast to a close?
Yes, absolutely. So the point is, if arguably the risk off or safe haven portion of your portfolio is, you know, at a, well, it's not arguably, it is at a greater historical extreme for sure than stocks or really any portion of the risk asset bucket by a long shot. Again, we don't know precisely how it unwinds. We don't know. We're not saying that, you know, the risk off or the safe haven portion of the portfolio is therefore extremely risky in some way. It's more to your point, which is it's not so much that it will cause inflation. It's that when there is a reason for inflation to occur, inflation has the opportunity to be that much more damaging and that much more intense, right? And so so that then is a really important risk to address. Stocks over long periods of time do address that risk. They tend to, you know, publicly traded stocks tend to be quite volatile in periods of inflation historically. So it's a bumpy ride, but it does protect your capital, in at least protect your capital in real terms over, you know, 15 to 20 years plus, you know, so longer periods of time. I think the real key is to look at, you know, other parts of the risk asset bucket, both with the question, you know, how does this or can this in part address the risk of inflation? And are there portions of the risk asset bucket that are more reasonably valued that can get a little bit more of your dollar that is allocated to risk assets? I think the point of this podcast is not so much to run through all of that, right? It includes real estate, private equity, alternative strategies. Again, maybe a conversation for another day. The point is, we think that should be the focus of the conversation, and we're kind of trying to lay out why, which is when you look at the economic fundamentals, the pandemic, all the problems that we face, election coming up, and you say this could be a really, a highly volatile several years from the fundamental point of view, then we argue the next step is, should we be taking a slice of our allocation to publicly traded equities and putting it in some other type of risk asset, right? In some other portion of the risk asset sub-asset classes. So, and then to us, that's like when the conversation gets really interesting, and that's how we protect and grow capital over long periods of time.
Well, surely in the immediate time that we find ourselves in, that bucket of growth assets has done very well.
Yes.
And people are buying that not just because they, it's Amazon and it's an online world, but it's Amazon, it's an online world, and there is growth, and you want to own growth stocks,
yes,
growth assets.
Yep.
In the face of inflation, we may have some kind of inflation, and we may have deflation of earnings at the same time.
For sure.
And in the face of that, we want to be sure that we have money in those buckets. And in fact, one of your hypotheses is that we actually could see a little bubble in that growth hedge. People,
yep,
have been surprised that the growth stocks have done so,
yes,
well,
yep,
have perhaps not understood, one, the risk of inflation, but two, that people want to own a basket of assets that come back in value first,
right,
coming out of a recession. So,
exactly. Exactly.
Okay, Mikio, thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Lively conversation. I hope that's beneficial to our friends. And
yes,
because we're really, this is about where to and how to see and how to be a solid long-term investor.
Exactly.
And to add the right amount of complexity, hopefully we did not overwhelm anyone, but to add the right amount of complexity to what it is to really navigate,
exactly,
a stormy time that we're in.
And what should our emotional and analytical energy be focused on?
Lovely.
So I do hope this has been helpful, and thanks so much for this conversation.
Thank you. Please take care, everyone.
Yes, please do.